Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season is upon us. We have IBM, Apple coming out next week. Oil, where's it going? Food prices, China's tightening, Europe, bullish sentiment all-time high, and we have yield spreads widening. That and much more on this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It is now the second week in January, towards the beginning of the year, and already seems like it happened overnight, doesn't it? It's going to be options expiration. Wow. Andrew Horowitz here, by the way. We have a great show for you today, and beyond all the things that we're going to talk about on the front end of the show today, I want to mention to you, we also have a great guest, David Gaffin, and he's going to tell us why you should never buy another stock again. We'll get into that. You probably know my feelings on that, but we'll kind of grill him on that when he gets online. Good friend of mine, currently writing for Reuters, used to write for the Wall Street Journal. Great journalist, great business journalist. A couple things I want to mention to you before we get into this today. Jim Rogers, I think, is on, not this week, next week, but the week after. Also, the Winning Investor Podcast, that's that five-minute quick down and dirty, well, a lesson, if you will, a teaching exercise in what to look for in the market, understanding jargon and some of the codex, if you will, technical analysis and getting deep into fundamental analysis and just a whole host of other things. A lot of questions of yours are answered. It is now number 3 on iTunes Business. It's about number 50 overall out of all the audio podcasts that are on iTunes. So thank you very much for moving that up. And I would, you know, just suggest that if you haven't had the opportunity, if you're looking for some more information about how to understand the markets and all the terminology, what is a good time to get into the stock market, you know, when to find trends, how to look at charts, what is a PE, what is a PEG ratio, and on, economic indicators, et cetera. You need to listen to that podcast. It's called The Winning Investor. Also, pick up my book right now, either at Amazon or any Barnes & Noble around the country. It's all available to you. It's called The Winning Investor's Guide to Making Money in Any Market, and that's part of the Quick and Dirty Tips Network, a great network that you really need to check out. So what else do we have to talk about today? So, as I'd mentioned, that earnings season has just started, right? We saw just last week Alcoa come out. We saw, who else did we see? We saw JP Morgan. And of course, in the mix of it all, we saw Intel. Well, what happened? Well, Alcoa comes out with their announcement and they were a little bit short on revenues and their EPS made it nicely. But there was some, well, disturbing commentary by the CEO. He was saying that it looks like there's going to be a slowdown in the aluminum business because China is starting to tighten. He has a concern about that, and rightfully so. And as a matter of fact, taking that one step further, if you watched what happened in the gold market last week, even though we saw the economy doing better, even though we saw inflation around the world clearly continuing to rise, even though we saw bond prices tick down a little bit, but most of the week they actually were moving up, even though we saw a variety of things that we would say that could be reason for gold to at least be steady, gold, silver, and many of the metals sold off dramatically. The question is, what are they really running on? Are they running on inflation, which most people think? Are they running on the idea that it's an alternative currency, that you have something tangible that you could actually spend one day? Or are they really running on supply and demand? Now, gold obviously is not used in many of the manufacturing, et cetera. You know, it's more of a, it's different than a silver, a palladium, a platinum. It's different than copper, of course. And you have to wonder how much of the assumption is baked into the equation for the long-term movement of metals, whether they're the precious metals or the industrial metals, that is all based on China's consumption. China clearly has an inflationary problem right now. Last reading came in about really hot at about 5.1%. And just before the weekend, they announced further tightening in the form of a 50 basis point increase to the reserve requirements they have at their banks, trying to slow down the loan business, if you will. And then on top of that, they also announced over the weekend that they are going to put a tax, a surtax, a penalty tax on buying of homes in order to try to slow down the red hot market for home prices because they've been escalating out of control due to speculation, first, second, third homes being bought, easy money supply that's out there, low interest rates. All of that has been fueling a tremendous boom in housing, which is causing a big problem because much of the country is unable to afford housing right now. In addition, we already know that much of the country, the poorest part of the country, are having major difficulty with food pricing. Last week, I believe we discussed that the FAO came out with their current level of food prices. How much is a basket of food? All, you know, not a basket like in Winn-Dixie or Publix, but a grouping of the food groups, whether it's meats, grains, etc. How much have they changed over time? And right now, they are at the highest price in history. Of course, some of that's due to the floods in Australia, Pakistan that we saw, the fires in Russia earlier in the year, the consumption, ethanol, which is being used to really, as an alternative or an additive to gasoline right now, which is being subsidized again by the U.S. government. Brilliant move that is. And eating into the corn prices, which of course are going to raise corn prices and then raise poultry prices, etc. It just trickles down all the way down. Unfortunately, and the worst hit are the poorest people of the world. Because food is a necessity. Oil is not. Always remember that. Oil clearly is a necessity when we deal with it for maybe heating. But you know what? You can still get away with less oil. But food and water are absolutely needed under any argument when it comes to the human being. There are many things that we don't need. We really don't need clothes. You know, of course, depending on where you live. So you have a little bit of sheepskin or some other kind of outer garment. We need shelter. But again, that could be relatively cheaply arranged. We don't really need oil. We don't need transportation. We used to live in a society that was, agriculture-based. We know that. The world was. But now, as we entered into the Industrial Revolution, and we entered into a time that the world obviously is now doing business with each other, things changed. Oil became, what we think is a necessity. But truth be known, the problem comes that there is a limited supply of that potentially, but food, of course, is the sustenance that keeps us living. Just remember that. As a matter of fact, I think that's a great segue into the fact that this is something that Jim Rogers believes in very, very deeply, and we'll talk to him about that in a couple of weeks when he comes on. But when we get back to earnings for a second, to shift back to that for a second, so Alcoa comes out with this idea that, they are concerned. We actually entered a short position for our clients. Not a big position, but a short position. Every single time Alcoa in the last several quarters has come out with earnings, it popped up and started slow, moving lower and lower and lower. And then optimism came back somewhere, and they thought that it could hit their numbers. And, of course, it just dropped down again. It is clear, though, that aluminum prices are moving higher. There is the question of whether or not an aluminum ETF will become available. But Alcoa doesn't really show great growth potential right now. Things did do better than they have done before. But again, our biggest concern was the fact that there was a revenue miss on them. Now, JP Morgan came out with some good numbers. Some of that was a tax benefit, and some of it was because of lowered loss reserves into the future. But their numbers actually look pretty good from the perspective that they have lower amount of losses. They have lower amount of loss reserve expectations, and their books are looking a bit better. The finance and banking sector really took off very nicely after the JP Morgan numbers. Intel, on the other hand, put up good numbers. And again, they put up one of their best quarters, if not their best quarter ever. But they're projecting that their margins are going to be compressed. They said the server market was really good. Really hot, the server market. But the rest of it was not as good. What was really interesting, though, is did you look at the semiconductor equipment manufacturers? Boy, they were smoking. Applied Materials was up like 7%, and a variety of the others were up 5, 6, 7%, because Intel said that there was a big demand in not only the server, but in the corporate market, that we're seeing that corporate IT spending is starting to pick up around the world. That's a good thing. Obviously, it's very apparent that the cloud computing phenomena, trend, wave, is fueling a lot of the server business. Very, very good for Intel. So far, those were pretty positive, generally speaking. You know, on the other hand, I will mention to you that, you know, you don't want to see what happens to a stock when it either misses or projects out a lower expectation. Case in point, last week was a company called CoinStar. Now, CoinStar is a company that has those red box, they have a few things, but the red box video rentals for like $1 or $2 that they put around. Great business model. Obviously, them and Netflix and a few others are just really just beating the crap out of Blockbuster. But when you look at this business model they have, it's been doing pretty well. Well, they come out with, I believe it was on Thursday, they came out with a projection for earnings and for revenue that was, you know, about 10% lower than we saw they had previously or what the street was expecting. Stock was immediately down 30% in the after-hour session. Now, not to get too excited that, well, that was just a short-term situation. A lot of sell stops were triggered. The next day it opened up. It went on from, I think, about 39 to about 43.5, and then back down to about 41 again. So at the end of the day, it was still down about 30%. My point, though, is to you that this earnings season, I think that investors are going to be a little bit more fickle about the numbers, because we've been allowing for a company to get a good EPS beat or meet without maybe too much growth, but at least they're kind of moving ahead a little bit faster, but yet revenues were not all there. The good news is that, well, at least potentially good news is that the S&P is projected to have record, all-time record earnings in the quarter that is coming, this quarter. If they meet the $80 plus $90 EPS on average number, in other words, they take the total and then divide it and assume the S&P is one stock, if you will, like a giant conglomerate. And if you look at that and the projections are, let's just say $90, that would be an all-time high for earnings per share for the S&P 500 companies. Pretty impressive if you think about it. What's more impressive is what I found this weekend when I was doing some research. The European Luxury Index that's done by Bloomberg, which includes companies like a Burberry and a Hermes and a variety of the big names that you could think of, Louis Vuitton, that are the luxury of luxury retail items. Do you know what? It is at an all-time high. Amazing, right? Amazing. Yeah, they took a big hit back in 2008, 2009. But you know, the money, again, going back to what we talked about, the housing overheating going on in China, the inflation and the money that has been pushed into much of the emerging markets is finding its way into things like luxury items. Look at Tiffany as an example. Look at Coach as another example. And then look at these companies like a Louis Vuitton, and Hermes and a Burberry, and et cetera, and you're finding that there is some spending going on. Now, obviously, we still have this remarkable problem that is not going to be solved very easily with unemployment. But you have to realize that there is more ways that a company could earn income than just from the U.S. consumer. You know, think about it for a second. If you were a company and you knew that there was a problem structurally in the unemployment rate and the unemployment situation in the U.S., and you still had other areas that you could profit from, wouldn't you expand there? Of course. That's what's happened. Question is going to be, how long can that be sustained? Countries like China and Korea and India and Brazil are all pushing on the brakes to try to slow down their economies. Their inflation rate has really been moving pretty dramatically, especially since the QE2 in August. And what is probably the most egregious of all, even though we just discussed how maybe it's not 100% required in life, but oil is probably projected to be at least $100 by the summer, barring any unforeseen circumstances. If we continue to see even the slightest scope of growth, which is now projected to be in the 3 to 3.5% GDP moving forward, we're going to see $100 oil, no problem. So that's something we need to look at. Next week, we're going to be looking very, very closely, of course. We're starting it off. Monday is a holiday in observance of the Martin Luther King holiday. And markets are closed, et cetera, on Monday. On Tuesday, we're going to get a couple of pieces of economic information. But next week, we have just an absolute barrage of earnings coming out. And not to mention the least of being Citibank, Apple, and IBM. Now, IBM, we'll talk to you about that for just a quick second. Clearly a bellwether of the blue chips in the area of not only service and hardware, but in cloud computing, et cetera. Well, one of the things that you have to wonder is, are they stealing a lot of business from their competitors? For example, Infosys, which is the main, we'll call it, computer consulting firm out of India, put up an okay number last week, but some concerning or questionable outlook. IBM clearly has been stealing some share, but, you know, and they bought some companies that were data storage and cloud computing related and all the other stuff, and they actually were getting some good business numbers the last few quarters, and that was starting to heat up. The question is, will they be able to maintain this? Right now, IBM closed, I think, at an all-time high last week, and we'll see if that can continue. Clearly, there's a lot of optimism going into the Apple numbers. We've seen a lot of companies raise their estimates into the 400 plus per dollar per share range for Apple over the last few weeks. And between the iPhone sales, the iPad sales, the growth into the world markets, as well as the fact that we're seeing that Verizon now is picking up the iPhone, which, by the way, as an aside, I have a question. My understanding is, I'm going to talk about John Dvorak with this on next Tuesday, Wednesday on DH Unplugged, but my understanding is that the Verizon network that the iPhone is going on is not the new LTE 4G network. It is the 3G network. And one of the reasons is that the iPhone did not want to retool itself, if you will, and it would cause too much incompatibilities with the iPhone to go on a different network. Now, okay, if that's true, we have to also think about the fact that the 3G network, I believe, or what they have over at Verizon, is a CDMA-based network, I believe. And if that's the case, you won't be able to utilize data and voice at the same time, even with the iPhone. Now, unless I am reading things wrong from all the research and the information directly from the Verizon website, et cetera, that I've seen, isn't that going to be a kind of a question like, why would I want that? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm spoiled. Yeah, I'm not in love with AT&T, but you know what? It serves its purpose for what I need it for. I really don't get that many drop calls. I don't have that many problems with it. But nonetheless, there are some places around the country. I will tell you that when I go there, like New York, for example, the reception has been just absolutely awful. But for the most part, I haven't had that problem. But what if I was talking on the phone and I want to check out, I don't know, directions somewhere? What if I was on the phone and I wasn't in Wi-Fi, of course? Or what if I'm on the phone and, I don't know, I wanted to send a text, or maybe that could be a little bit different. But, I don't know, look up something on the web, or playing a game, or 100 different things. Will I have a problem with that? And will the consumer say, hey, you know what? We want the full-blown opportunity to have it all. We want the text, and we want the the voice and the data to be available to us at all times. Now, maybe, again, I'm reading this wrong, and maybe I'm seeing something that's not there, but it seems to me that that's what it is. If you want to tell me I'm wrong about this, just put a comment on the show notes for this episode. It'll be on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Send me an email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Educate me. If I'm wrong about this, I'd like to know. But it does leave a little bit of a question mark in my mind of how many people from AT&T will actually switch over to Verizon with that knowledge. And how many people, of course, are going to say they're going to leave their Android phone that they did maybe as a substitute until, a placeholder, if you will, until the iPhone came to Verizon. So I don't know. We'll see about that. But I think that's really kind of an interesting question that has to be addressed. But we'll see next week just how well Apple has done. We know they have a habit of giving us outward and forward views of being very conservative. So, I don't know, we'll see what happens. I mean, it looks like they had a pretty good quarter with this last quarter, as a matter of fact. So, all things being equal, we'll see. Last week, Europe, the events in Europe, we saw that the Portuguese had a good, quote, unquote, a good auction that sent the euro up because everybody is, wow, that's so great. Everything's great over there. People are buying their bonds. Oh, it's wonderful. Oh, come on. I mean, the amount of BS that is coming out of Europe, whether it's from Jean-Claude Trichet, whether it's the reversals on a continual basis by Angela Merkel over in Germany, whether it's the crap that spews out of the Prime Minister of Greece's mouth regarding that everything is fine over there. I mean, come on. They have major problems. The euro clearly took a nice bounce after it hit about 127.5, back up to about, as close as 134 over about a week and a half period, or 1 week period, I should say. But the underlying, I guess, it's more than just the underlying problem. It's a structural inefficiency, a structural breakdown of the eurozone situation, whereas we're seeing really Germany as the core of it all that's holding it all together. And the question is, how long is that going to last? How long are the Germans going to allow for an unlimited amount of money to bail out countries that don't have any kind of, responsibility to the euro? In other words, they don't really care. They keep on getting themselves into trouble. They keep on saying that things are okay. And then, you know, all of a sudden we wake up one day and things aren't. So, you know, when it comes to the bonds, don't be fooled right off the bat, because don't forget also, there's a lot of players out there that have a lot, like as in countries, by the way, that have a lot to lose if these auctions don't go well. So what they'll do is they'll put up money and buy the bonds. Listen, last week, Japan said they were going to do it. They're going to buy the European debt. Why? Well, they need Europe to continue doing what they're doing. They'd like the euro to go higher. They'd like the yen to go lower. Same thing with China. But at the same time, you have to realize something. It's really important. Even though the Portugal and the Spanish debt auctions went well, or as well as can be expected, or better than can be expected, the fact is they're paying the highest rates in history on their debt. The highest rates in history, in a time when they have lower revenues and they're seeking fiscal austerity. So think about the equation there, and frankly, it doesn't work. Now, is it going to end up in an all-out catastrophe? And we'll see. But you know what? There's a lot more that's going to be coming out about this, and I don't think that the final shoe has dropped. Just like the municipal bond issue in the U.S. is still kind of going through its, you know, fluctuations right now. Now, we'll kind of touch on a couple other points I want to mention to you. You know, I wrote about this for our quarterly commentary that goes out to clients, and it's something we put together on a quarterly basis to see, okay, what happened last quarter from an economic and a general standpoint around the world, and at the same time, what are we looking for? What are some of the trends that may be happening, particularly in the beginning of the year? We look at trends that may be occurring that we want to look at. One of the things that I looked at, and I may have mentioned this before, was that, you know, it's pretty astonishing that after the QE2 came out, the long bond rates went up so dramatically. They dipped down initially with fear that Bernanke was going to come in and just flood the market with long bond purchases to bring down the rates on mortgages, etc., and for quote-unquote helping the unemployment situation, which, again, nobody's explained to me, and I can't figure out how buying treasuries by the Fed is going to help the unemployment situation. But we'll put that aside for now. When we look at that, I think actually, if we really think about it, just for a second, if we really think about, is it possible that the politically expedient, the politically acceptable and correct thing to say was that the reason that the Treasury bonds were going to be purchased by the Fed was to bring down the mortgage rate so that the housing market could heal and we are going to try our best to bring unemployment under control, rather than if he said, we're going to be buying $600 billion worth of bonds in the mid part of the yield, pressing down the yield dramatically, which will probably bulge the long end of the curve. Even though that's going to hurt the mortgage rates, it's really going to steepen the curve dramatically and help the banks. And as we help the banks, they're going to be able to be much more profitable, because the steeper the yield curve, the better for them. And potentially that would allow them to then go out and lend, because if they can, they could borrow, if the banks could borrow at the very, very short end at the lowest rates in history and then lend out to people at a much higher rate, you know what? They will take more risk on. Huh. Interesting. Nobody talks about this. Maybe because it's lunacy. Maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I'm just way off on a tangent here. Maybe I'm just thinking that that can't be right. I got to listen to what the Fed says and listen to them directly, not try to think about what actually the results were and think that they were so brilliant in their maneuvering and the way that they encapsulated all this and couched this to make it sound good for us, but the results are much different. The truth be told, that right now the spread between the 2 and the 30-year Treasury is the widest it is in history. That can't be just a mistake, can it? That can't be what Bernanke was looking to do to raise up the 30-year, the 20-30-year, which is what directly impacts mortgages? No. Why would he do such a thing? Wait a minute. Oh, the banks need some more help. If we help the banks, blah, 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 blah. That's the reason we think. So in the end, that's why banks have been rising over the last month and a half, the realization that the yield curve that has been so steep and so wide for the 2 to 30 from the short to long end has been very beneficial and will be to the banks. And the, well, maybe the condition will allow for banks to go out there and start lending again. We'll have to see about that. Well, anyway, we talked all about that. I think the other thing that we're going to have to do is, I guess we'll kind of bring in David Gaffin. I think you'll enjoy him. I've always had a nice time talking with him in the past. It's been a while since I actually talked to him. Last time I talked to him, he was over at the Wall Street Journal writing for them. And right now he's editing and writing over at Reuters. So when we get back, we'll bring on David Gaffin talking about his book, which is Never Buy Another Stock Again. I can't wait to talk to him. All right, we're on the phone with a friend of mine that I haven't talked to in a while. He's now at Reuters, previously at the Wall Street Journal. His name is David Gaffin, wrote a book called, get this, Never Buy Another Stock Again, The Investing Portfolio That Will Preserve Your Wealth and Your Sanity. And before I say anything, and David will confirm this, when he first called me and said, hey, Andrew, just want to let you know I wrote a book. I said, well, what's the name? And he told me, I said, oh, really? Right, didn't I?
Yep.
So I said, okay, we're going to have a little debate, and I hope you don't worry, you know, get upset about it. He said, Dad, listen, throw it at me. But let's talk seriously for a second. Great book, by the way. And, you know, I think that it obviously, as any book, any piece, it has its place. Tell me a little bit about the kind of like, you know, what was the genesis? What was the thought process, and why did you want to write this?
I mean, I think some of it comes from the fact that I see that for a long time, you know, after a very long bull market, that was interrupted briefly by, you know, the technology bubble and subsequent breakdown, people got to thinking that all of this was really easy. And I think that for the casual observer, the casual investor, so to speak, that I felt like that there had to be something written that would address, you know, the concerns that people would have about, you know, whether they were somehow missing something by not doing what everyone else was doing and trading like mad. And also just point out that there were ways for people to go about saving their money and getting their situations in order for both education, for retirement, or what have you, without necessarily having to become a stock trader. And, you know, I thought that a simple approach for, you know, the average person who has, let's say, a two-income family with, you know, limited amounts of time to do lots of things, kids to take care of, jobs, you know, a house to take care of, all of these other obligations, that then to try to layer in understanding individual stock shares was a bit too much from my perspective. And I thought there was a way to approach that, of course, with a, you know, provocative title, and, you know, go from there. So for the stock jockeys and for people who absolutely love this and want to sit in front of the computer screens all day and, you know, get in and out of positions and trade options and do what have you, well, then perhaps this isn't the exact book. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a book for Jim Cramer.
Right.
You know, but as I quote in the book, Cramer has had some pretty good advice for people who, you know, he feels or who themselves feel are not equipped for this. That if you're not spending an hour a week on your positions, well, you know, you're risking yourself being open to surprises and things happening that you're not prepared for.
Yeah.
And in that case, I think that there is another direction people should be going. And that was that. So that was the genesis of the book.
So, you know, it's interesting because I tend to agree with you from this perspective. You know, I just wrote a book. I don't know if I sent it to you, but The Winning Investor. And basically I have a chapter on, okay, who are you? You know, do you want to be involved or what we're calling, to make it really easy, the super passive investor? You kind of like, you know, have a portfolio, whether it's 401k, whatever, and just kind of don't want to deal with it, don't like it for whatever reason it may be. And at the same time, you realize you have to be invested. So what do you do? Right. So, but here's one of the things I want to talk about with you. I think throughout the book, there's a variety of different things that you talk about. One of the things that kind of, I don't know if you really even hit on this exactly directly, but one of the things that I've always noticed is there is a brainwashing that has gone on. And we're just going to focus on the United States for a second. With U.S. investors, that, you know, there's a certain way to invest. You know, shorting is bad. Going long is the way to do it. Be diversified. Blah, blah. And you kind of talk about some of the pitfalls with a lot of that, right?
Yeah. Try to anyway.
Yeah, okay. You do a good job on that. Yeah. But diversification, let's talk about that, because I know you hit upon this. And this is something that really bugs me, because not in your book, but the concept of this. And I think you discussed this properly. Diversification, just the word itself, is not just necessarily you have a lot of things in your portfolio. That's not really maybe truly diversification, particularly when asset classes are highly correlated. Talk to that a little bit.
I think you're right. And it's something that I noticed, is that, you know, you'll have people who think they're diversified when they have, let's say they have 8 funds. One is a bond fund, so okay, fine. And then you have 7 equity funds. One's like a small cap, one's an index fund, one's a large cap. You know, maybe one is developed markets and then developing markets. And, you know, especially lately, markets have been very correlated. But even when, you know, markets are not quite as correlated as they have been of late, you know, the small caps and the large caps and the index funds, they're overlapping quite a bit. And, so you have a lot of, you know, as you put it, things or stuff in your portfolio, different things. But are they markedly different from each other? Not at all. They're very similar. And, you know, one of the challenges when writing this book was, you know, thinking about diversification, saying, okay, I do have to address it. But then, so what am I going to say beyond bonds and stocks? I mean, and how do you go from there? And I did hit upon the idea that, you know, emerging markets, that they are, you know, more often than not going to be as correlated with, you know, United States stocks. That you can find ways to try to invest in high-yield bonds, you know, as easily as possible through ETFs, through corporate loan market, or anything that is just, you know, an actual different asset class as opposed to things that are sort of all kind of in the same asset class. And that was the idea, you know, trying to, you know, address, you know, the diversification argument, because as you say, people just keep saying diversification and they don't really get a handle on what that really means.
Right. So, I guess there's also something else that I wanted to talk with you about. And let me start with a question. It's a very broad-based question, and I'm going to lead into something. But what is the purpose of investing? So if I was to ask not you, but the big you, right? Not your particular portfolio. What's the point of investing? What do you think the general answer is?
I think the general answer for investing is so that you have enough money to deal with and to pay for every, you know, your obligations as they come down the road. Most of the time we're talking about retirement or college education that you're paying for your children, but essentially, you know, so that you can have money that's not going to be stagnant, you know, and therefore, you know, essentially to live at a time when you can't work, because people are not going to work for the rest of their life.
Okay, I'm with you. So now, the point that you make, let me tie this up a different way. So the point you're making here is that the investing is coordinated with a goal that you will have for your life to have enough money to live in whatever the circumstances you are that you want to live, you know, obviously within reason.
Right.
Then why are so many people fixated and absolutely compulsive about the Dow Jones and in the S&P 500, because it almost looks like it has been this massive amount of brainwashing that you have to be with the S&P 500. Now, I don't know about you, but I have no idea what the S&P 500 necessarily has to do with my retirement or my college education plans for my kids. And this is a real pet peeve of mine that everything is benchmarked against that or something else. You can pick whatever you want, whether it's the Wilshire, whether the small caps. And it's almost like I understand why a mutual fund will do that, that has a certain style, and that is the style they want to match themselves accordingly, and they're in that box. But why is it that we have this, more than a fascination, this compulsion with beating the S&P 500? What is that all about?
I think you really hit on something here, and it's the truth. And yes, when you're dealing with a mutual fund or a manager who manages money and wants to prove their worth, they have to benchmark against something. They can't just say, well, I'm doing well. You know, well, based on what? And the S&P and the Dow are proxies that have been around for a long, long time and therefore have that value. But for your life or for my life, what do I need to know if I'm beating the S&P 500 for you? You're exactly right. I mean, let's say you have enough money so that you're going to be able to live reasonably comfortably already through the rest of your life, but you need to just make sure that your money is, you know, is earning money and that, you know, it is being used wisely and profitably. So do you need to be in stocks then? I mean, maybe you don't. Maybe that's a person that needs to be in fewer stocks. And if they gain 4% a year, then they'll be fine for their situation. And a person who needs more than that and unfortunately has to invest then, you know, to go out on a limb and invest more aggressively, maybe, you know, the average for the S&P 500 is not going to be enough for them. You know, and if you have an amount of money that you're looking at and you need to try to reach for your retirement to be a comfortable one, you're right. I mean, who cares what the S&P 500 does?
Right, but it seems like every single investor is totally fascinated with that whole issue, and it's a shame because, you know, here's what goes along with that. If I'm with the S&P 500, within reason, you know, whether I don't care if the S&P 500 is up 10% and I'm up 5, I don't know, I'm picking a number, or up 11, or whatever the number is. If it's, or I should say this even better, if the market's going up and I'm going up, I'm happy. But here's the dangerous part. Everybody seems to still be happy when the market goes down and they're down because everybody else is down anyway.
Right.
And that's where that I have this horrible sense that everybody believes that it's okay to follow the herd. And I don't know about you, but, you know, if the herd is, you know, running off the edge of a cliff, why bother following them?
Exactly. Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying? It's kind of this absurd situation. But you know what? The mutual funds are okay with that because they want you to believe, and that's how they keep your money. And you know, certain money managers that have the same philosophy with that. So I think that's a big issue. You talk about ETFs a little bit. Do you think the ETF universe has gotten a little bit crowded?
It feels like it's starting to. And, you know, the thing that I wonder is whether, you know, the crowding is coming in the more and increasingly esoteric parts of the market. And, you know, some of these ETFs are coming out now that are just, you know, meant to match the market's volatility. And that's a fine vehicle perhaps for, you know, professional investors, you know, who want to use it as a hedging, you know, resource. But, you know, for a retail customer, I don't see why they would ever, you know, need such a thing. You know, the ones that are sector-based, they're just, you know, you're not necessarily diversifying yourself if you're buying a bunch of different sectors in that way. And again, professional investors are going to be reacting a little bit differently, and they're using things for different reasons, and they are the target in a lot of these things. But it is getting certainly crowded, and I worry that, you know, we will see some sort of blow-up somehow. And, you know, of course, people are poo-pooing that now and saying that, of course, it won't happen, and they're just trying to match this and that and the other thing. But, you know, there's always that danger that's out there, especially when you're dealing with ETFs that are tracking instruments that they can't exactly track because of tracking errors, because of, you know, not being able to source the underlying investments, like if it's a bond ETF or something like that. I mean, you know, the S&P 500 stock index ETF is I feel still a no-brainer. I mean, that's tracking the entire market. It's, you know, that seems to be a pretty straightforward and safe kind of investment. But when you have things tracking, you know, all sorts of bond funds, and different types of bond investments, while it's getting much more, you know, that's much more difficult. And you introduce, as I said, tracking errors, and you introduce higher expenses, and that's when it gets a little hairy. So yes, I think it is getting a little bit more crowded, and I think the allure of being able to trade these things is largely what's driving that.
Well, let me tell you my take on this, and this goes back a little bit. But I think that the ETFs are a good vehicle. I agree with you. They're a cheap form if you want to do indexing. So I'm agreeing with you with that. The problem, I think, is that, as always, they are potentially bastardized in that there was a lot of, you know, do you remember about a year and a half ago or so when we had these days in the market that everything is just going along very nicely and all that, then all of a sudden, the last half hour, something severe would happen, up or down.
Yep.
No reason, really, to be honest. There was just something, you know. We haven't seen that in a while, you know, at that level I'm talking about, you know, 1% move in 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, it was for a while there, it was just every day.
Right. Well, what happened is, in my opinion, they were using leveraged ETFs and futures and shoving it in with low volume days and then making all sorts of money on the futures and on the leveraged ETFs.
Right.
I mean, it was a no-brainer in a way. They can, you know, make tons of money on a daily basis just by doing that. Now, you didn't know which way it was going a lot of times, so you had to be careful if you were going to follow that thesis or that flow. But more so, I think the problem that I have with ETFs is I think the sectors have an interesting place. I'll tell you why. Let's say that I'm an investor for whatever reason. I don't know what the reason is. For whatever reason, I have a yearning to be in technology. Okay, I don't know if I should buy Apple. I don't know if I should buy IBM or HP or whatever that is. Okay, I can go out and buy a technology ETF that has a basket of technology stocks in there, assuming that's, you know, the direction I want to go. If I want to be in biotech and I don't know, I don't want a company blowing up because all of a sudden their phase two trial, you know, went off you know, FDA approved list and the stock goes down 40%. So the good thing is that there are those sectors that are available and potentially can help you through diversification, because we know that in different times of the cycle that, you know, different things will perform, whether it's, you know, in the peak of the trough of the economic cycle. But the problem I have with ETFs are these commodity-based ETFs. And let me share something with you. So
sure.
There's a lot of talk about, oh, it looks like they're going to be starting an aluminum ETF, right? You've heard this?
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, yeah. I'm thinking, let me get this straight. So a commodity, which is often used for materials for building something, whatever it may be, okay, let's take aluminum, now is going to be owned by the masses for non-manufacturing purposes, we'll say, right?
Right.
Which, doesn't that mean that has to drive up the price of aluminum?
You would think it would after we see what's happened with gold. I mean,
right.
Unless, you know, I mean, gold certainly seems to be driven now by this sort of speculation and you know, mass belief that, you know, it is, you know, some sort of new uncorrelated asset to everything. And, you know, thankfully we can all buy it in this ETF kind of thing. And now we have the silver.
Right.
Which those two have been around a while, but now a copper, and then you have a platinum, palladium one, the white metals one, or what have you.
Right.
And, you know, it just continues to go there and from there and so on and so forth. And, yeah, you know, you're talking about, you know, you have a good point. I mean, with an aluminum ETF, you know, you're talking about a raw material good that is used for production over everything else.
Right.
You know, well, what happens, you know, do we do one for wheat, too, and grains?
There is one out there, DBA, the DBA. Let me tell you the one we want to do.
Yeah, that's right.
I have one. Ready? The ETF of 2011 is going to only buy, it's going to be a very, very, very distinct sector, okay? It's going to buy the book Never Buy Another Stock Again. And,
that's a nice ETF.
Right? And and they're going to load up on that book and hold it in a fortress somewhere and just, you know, store the actual book. So think about that. Is there anything different that I just said from that to Alcoa wanting an aluminum ETF? There's no difference.
Right.
There's no.
No
difference.
No.
So I think this commodity ETF issue, especially when we deal with the rolling futures dates, if you ever look at, for example, the problem with natural gas ETF, which does not track the natural gas pricing well at all due to some contango issues and their rolling futures and all these different ETFs that have are future-based, different than some of the other stock ones, are going to be a problem somewhere down the road. You know, if nothing else, I mean, how are they going to store all this stuff? And then, you know, what happens when it goes down? Do they sell it? And then what? Do they flood the market with it? You know, it's a different discussion now, right? So if they have the actual material that they're holding and backing up this investment, which most people like, if it starts dropping a lot of selling, do they just blow it out of the market? And then does that do a double whammy on the share price?
Right, exactly.
You know?
And you know, you can definitely foresee something like that happening with many of these ETFs that have risen to unfathomable heights and then pushed the prices as well of those underlying materials to those levels.
Right. So let me switch gears with you. Let me switch gears with you for a second, okay? So we're going to talk about the book a little bit, some of the things that are going on out there. Let's talk about reporting for a second. Can we do that? How many years have you been reporting?
About 16.
16. Journalism. 15,
yeah.
15, 16. Yep. That's not the politically correct thing to say, I am sorry. But reporting is the right word, I guess, or being a journalist.
Yeah.
And finance.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of changes. Have you noticed? I get very irritated. I know that, and I know this, what I'm about to say, and it may not be related exactly to you or to Reuters right now and all that, but there are, tagline title people out there that their job is to make the sexiest headline possible so that the underlying story will be read. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So sometimes what you get is, you know, a really great headline, and the story could be great also, by the way, but it may not exactly match the story. You know, you're reading something, you're like, whoa, what does that have to do with anything there? And obviously the difference is right now where you used to have just the front page of a newspaper that people are looking for to pick up and then scan through. Now you have the opportunity to do page impressions and then to get paid for per click. So my question to you is, have you seen a change, dramatic change, in the last 5 years in reporting? I'll throw one other thing at you. And the vetting process for financial reporting over the last 5 years, especially since the advent of online reporting?
I'm not sure, because I feel like the real changes that have come have been coming, you know, in terms of the ongoing monopolization of the media by mostly larger organizations, of which I have to say, I guess mine is one of them.
Yes.
But, you know, and you get to a point where, you know, you have a lot of the media that I think is following, you know, it's trend following for one thing, and then secondly, you know, you've gotten a lot of people who have become very chummy with and you know, sort of speak on the level of those that they're covering. You know, so they're much less sort of the sort of, you know, unvarnished, scrappy, ink-stained wretch type of, you know, persona that had been the previous sort of, way journalism had been, you know, regarded. And now it's something a little bit more different. And so, you know, I feel like we, you know, sometimes miss the bigger stories that, you know, sometimes can be caught up to by, you know, perhaps bloggers or things like that.
Right.
You know, I don't think that the media did a great job with the banking crisis, and I think it did okay with the housing bubble, but not so much what came after that. I've kind of veered off, and so I'm not really answering your question, but, you know, I think there is definitely always been some interest in sort of grabby, you know, sexy headlines, I mean, and trying to write to that sometimes, but...
Right.
That part I'm not sure is appreciably worse. I think that there's definitely, you know, an eye to writing shorter pieces and trying to grab as much in the way of eyeballs as possible,
right,
as you have pointed out.
Right.
So that's
the other thing is that, and I'm not attacking you at all. I'm just talking to you as, you know, someone I've known for a while, and I know I can have an honest discussion with about this. And I think that, you know, the listeners appreciate this. What is the story with the the news reporters now being the news? In other words, I think that's what you were alluding to a second ago, that they're now the opinion makers rather than the reporters of the opinions. That's a big thing that's going on, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that I would put a lot of it onto, you know, the continued rise of cable television. And then I think the internet plays into that to some extent as well, that, you know, we've gotten to a point where people have moved away from what they consider to be sort of the more austere kind of, you know, off, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand kind of thing, and, you know, much more of a, you know, desire to take a louder view, so to speak, and the sort of very straightforward kind of style of, you know, I don't know what, like the BBC on television is less favored right now. I mean, it's out of favor. And these things wax and wane, you know, but for right now, it seems like it's become a much more, you know, opinion-driven kind of approach by a lot of the media.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the other thing I have, and maybe we can close on this, and maybe just some final thoughts, but I have been very much surprised. In the old days, and you know, you go back a while, if I'm, tell me where I'm wrong on this, but you did a story, you usually had to have two sources, at least opposing sources, And after you finished your work, you send it to an editor and you get vetted, and you know, maybe they call up one of the sources to identify them, et cetera. And there was very, very, very rarely unidentified sources just laid out there. Would you agree with that commentary?
I agree. I would agree that the unidentified sources thing has becoming more and more of a scourge, so to speak.
Yeah.
In all aspects of reporting, whether it's business, politics, sports, what have you. And I think that, you know, I understand where it comes from when, you know, you're dealing with, you know, some real high-level kind of government secret type stuff or things where you really can't risk exposing the person in question. But, you know, because of the fact that you've confirmed it elsewhere and the reporting you're doing, you can invest a certain trust in that source. We've gotten to the point now where anonymous sources are being used for every last little thing.
Right.
And at times just to, you know, criticize someone else. And if you're, you know, which is the worst kind of, you know, anonymous sourcing, because then you're quoting someone who's not even really putting their name behind,
right,
you know, what they're saying. And you're giving them, you know, more or less a free voice to go on about somebody else that they're talking about. So I think that has gotten very, very overdone, and I feel like it needs to be used, you know, judiciously with you know, situations where you've gotten confirmation from different areas, and then, you know, you've been able to make that judgment from there. You know, it's become much more lax, which
but the problem is the problem is that we all know whether we want to, you know, really say it outward or not, that the governmental battle to save economies, whether it's Europe or whether it is testing the waters here on stress tests, has been a parade of rhetoric that is used to test the, is my opinion here, to test the waters via the press by leaking stories and by providing information from sources that will remain anonymous due to whatever reason. And it seems to me that the press is being used and allowing themselves to be used so that maybe they can get the scoop, or at least they get a piece of the story.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of trial balloons that get floated by senior government sources and things like that. And we in the press, I think, really have to do a good job in trying to figure out if, you know, we're being simply used for, you know, such, you know, a trial balloon, or if there's an actual story there. And we are hungry for scoops, and so therefore, you know, that's where, you know, if we're not careful and we let our guard down, you end up, you know, writing stories that are end up sort of mouthpieces for whoever's doing the speaking.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. I appreciate your honesty on that. You're a great writer, and of course, David Gavin can be found on Reuters. He writes for them, as well as the fact that his new book, which is out now and available, Never Buy Another Stock Again, the investing portfolio that will preserve your wealth and your sanity. We'll have a link to that on the show notes for this week. And Dave, we'll talk soon.
That sounds great. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. I'll put a link to Dave's book on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I do encourage you to check it out on a regular basis, because we're always writing about things like maybe we'll put a little idea for what's happening with economic stocks, some earnings things that we've seen. We'll talk about a particular sector. There's all sorts of things that we write about on a regular basis over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's kind of what we do for our clients, too. We talk about the portfolio and what's happening, what we're doing, because we like to have this kind of transparent process so that everybody knows what's going on. Because there's so many times, I don't know if you have you realized that so many times you have things in your account and with your current broker or your money manager, or you're like, what is that? Why do I have that? What's the rationale? Why do we buy that? And on and on and on. So that's kind of something that we really think is important. And that's, our clients just love it. You know, they're always telling me that, hey, this is great. We get to see what's happening and full transparency and why you're doing this. And if we agree with you, if we don't, we can say something. You know, it's just a great atmosphere to be involved in, where you have control, or at least, you know, you have the access to the information that's happening. It's not being done to you, but you're part of the process. I also want to mention to you that you could find that the Disciplined Investor is available, of course, on iTunes, and so is the Winning Investor. And I encourage you to make sure to put that in your podcast library. And also, DH Unplugged is available for you as well. And, of course, if you want to contact me, just simply just ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I think that's pretty much all we had. I had a few questions that we got from listeners that we're going to, I think next week we're going to try to bring a lot of them to the front. We also have some ideas on some areas that we're going to improve on in terms of throughout the year, some things we're going to try to do, some more apps. A lot of people like the apps. And you could, as a matter of fact, if you think about it, send me some of your favorite financial apps. I'd like to check them out, both for the iPhone and for the Android and for BlackBerry. We're going to keep it for the mobile side right now. Tell me what you like and what you don't like. Tell me what it's about real quickly. Just give me a one-line, two-line about it, and we'll check it out and see if it's something worthwhile, because we're always looking for the latest and greatest in financial applications and apps that can be used. And then finally, I think that just to let you know that when it comes to, you know, taking a look at you know, tracking your portfolio and all that, there's a couple of great sites out there. I'd like to know what you use. You could also, you know, tell me that. We'll also put that out there for you to, you know, once we get those all together, we'll try to have a show based on all of that, because a lot of people are always asking about, where do I get information? You know, how do I find out this? And where's the best place to get a stock quote? As a matter of fact, somebody wrote me last week and said, you know, this place says that the dividend is 7%. This place says it's 2%. What do I believe? You know, where do you look? Where do you go? So, you know, that's a big issue that you need to deal with, is what information can you trust? Because garbage in is garbage out. We know that. Anyway, we'll talk to you real soon. I thank you for joining me today for episode number 195 on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Make sure to tune in right here over the next few weeks. We have some exciting things happening. We have Jim Rogers coming on, some great guests, some great commentary, and I really appreciate you being there for it. Starting off 2011 with a real bang. We'll see you real soon. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.